I think we need to start thinking more and more seriously about Elon risk. You know, there's a term in software called platform risk, right? Where if you rely on other people's platforms, those platforms will change and shift and erode and cannibalize you. And we need to think about Elon risk as actually a global threat.
Whoa.
Emil can't keep a straight face.
Off you go.
I mean, thank God for Elon. Like, holy shit. He's like a gift to humanity. Seriously.
You're listening to the Startup Podcast. This is a Reacts episode. Industry insiders having frank debates about the latest tech, politics, and business news. Whether you're a founder, investor, or operator in a startup, you'll gain insights into how current events connect to broader themes and trends that impact your startup, your investments, and your day-to-day operational decisions. The conversation starts now.
Hi, I'm Emil Michael.
I'm Chris Sard.
And I'm Yaniv Bernstein.
In today's episode, we are going to cover Figure AI, raising $675 million from OpenAI, Microsoft, NVIDIA, Intel, and more. What does it mean for robotics and AI? How does it change the world? And will we have our own Jetson-style robots serving us any moment now? And we're going to talk about Elon Musk suing OpenAI for breach of contract and violating his trust in pivoting from a nonprofit to a commercial entity. And we talk about open source versus closed sourced AI. How does AI compare to the Manhattan Project? And how will the geopolitics play out in terms of safety, security, and multipolar world? All that and more on this week's The Startup Podcast Reacts. Stay tuned.
This episode of The Startup Podcast is brought to you by Vanta. You might know that sinking feeling. You're about to land a big contract when they ask about compliance. SOC 2, ISO, PCI, Essential 8. You've just snatched defeat from the jaws of victory. Not anymore. Vanta massively accelerates your compliance efforts and allows you to get those life-changing deals back on track. Don't wait until it's panic stations, though. Get started with Vanta today. They're offering 20% off their prices just for TSP listeners. Do yourself a favor. Hit pause. Go to vanta.com/TSP. That's VANTA.com to get that 20% off.
All right. The first thing we wanted to talk about today was Figure AI raising $675 million from investors, an all-star lineup of investors, including Jeff Bezos, NVIDIA, Microsoft, OpenAI, Intel's in there somewhere, I think. Now, Figure, you may not have heard of them yet. I suspect you're going to hear a lot about them in the coming weeks and months. They are essentially building humanoid robots. They are bringing AI into the real world. They're bringing iRobot to life. These things look like iRobot, basically. They look like Elon Musk's Optimus. And you know, I think it makes a hell of a lot of sense embedding on an independent, dedicated third party to do this. Boston Dynamics seems to be doing hardcore hydraulic stuff, and Elon Musk seems to be doing everything he can get his hands on. But a dedicated company doing this is very interesting. And obviously, NVIDIA and Intel and Microsoft and OpenAI agree. So what do you guys think about Figure? What do you think about robotics? What do you think about the marriage between robotics and AI? And where do you think this is going in the short to medium term?
I think that we are entering a new wave of robotics excitement. There was the last wave, if you remember Boston Dynamics and all the videos that they were showing of this humanoid thing jumping and so on. And then Optimus from Elon came along and Figure came along. And this notion that these LLMs are either going to learn from these robots or teach these robots is this kind of new idea that I think has generated some real excitement there. The CEO of Figure, I think, was at Archer Aviation, apparently a good salesman. And if you look at the videos, they're pretty cool. But it feels like a lot of sizzle. Ask her how much stake there is yet in this notion of a humanoid robot. What are you going to do with it? How is it going to cost? When's it going to be deployed? Is this another driverless car timeline or what? So it's a little, feels ahead of itself.
So robotics has been on this weird dual track for decades now, where there's the science fiction and trying to make it come true with the human robots and the AI speaking to you and so on. And that's been a little bit like nuclear fusion, sort of always 30 years away. And then in the meantime, robotics has massively impacted manufacturing and industry, depending on how you define robots. I saw a thing just a couple of months ago about how automated Amazon's warehouses have become. They are full of robots. So in that sense, robotics is nothing new. Robotics impacting the world is nothing new. to your point, Emil, like the technology is really impressive. Boston Dynamics has been really impressive for years. You're like, God damn, like that thing can move like crazy. But is the idea of a general purpose humanoid form actually the direction that the industry should be taking when we have lots of specialized robots doing all sorts of things and have been doing them for decades?
We have a tendency to chase these shiny objects like, oh my God, robots are coming. It's like, actually, robots have been here for quite some time. But I think the thing we're really excited about, you know, similarly to AI, is general intelligence in terms of cognition and reasoning. Here, I think we're excited about general robotics in the sense of two arms, two legs, navigating the world and taking instructions and learning on the fly. And so you might call this generalized robotics paired with artificial generalized intelligence means a very different future than fixed arms in an Amazon warehouse, right? And I think there's at least five things that are interesting to me about this immediately. The first is the players, the OpenAIs and Microsofts and NVIDIAs of the world backing a single robotics company is clearly a form of validation that's hard to get. That's like, okay, these guys are legit. And if they weren't legit before, they're legit now. Right, they have access to the most interesting engineering and capital and deepest pockets around. And whether they can take that attention and that capital and turn it into Tesla or turn it into Faraday Future will be yet to be seen, right? Are they going to be a giant multi-billion dollar crater or are they going to actually ship real products? To your point, Emil, we just don't know. The other thing I think that's interesting about it is hydraulics versus electric. And I've been watching a lot of stuff from the founder of Boston Dynamics. And it strikes me that Boston Dynamics really chose a very particular route with their hydraulics. And their stuff is just really heavy and really complicated. And he described it as leaky, right? Like it literally leaks fluid. He's personally interested in hydraulics and he took the company in that direction. And Spot was a challenge that one of the founders of Google put to him is like, hey, how do you make this thing smaller and electric? And that was the only reason they did Spot. So a company that is really focused on electronic servos and lightweight reproducibility, I think, is a really compelling idea. The other thing that strikes me is, you know, obviously the era of hard tech is back. For the longest time in Silicon Valley, you went to somebody with a bit of hard tech, a VC with hard tech, and they'd be like, get out of here, you idiot. It's just like...
should be doing vertical SaaS.
Yeah, vertical SaaS. B2B SaaS all day long. Consumer social all day long. On-demand marketplaces. Why aren't you building the Uber for X? And it's like, now there's space, there's capital, there's opportunity for solving really, really hard capital-intensive problems, both on the software side and the hardware side. And that's a sea change that I think our founders listening needs to pay attention to. The final two things I want to say on this quickly is, this is generative AI coming for blue-collar work at a whole other level. Obviously, blue-collar work was addressed by these robot arms in the factory. And then we got all scared that ChatGPT is going to come after white-collar information work. But now this is the eye of Sauron, the eye of AI Sauron, shifting its attention back to blue collar work. And that is going to reshape the economy top to bottom.
Can I challenge that? I don't see what this has to do with generative AI. Blue collar work doesn't need generative AI, right? This is much closer to autonomous vehicles or something like that, where you're like, okay, this is about having a really complex spatial understanding of the world combined with some sort of reasoning system and then with incredible hardware that can actually actuate that. I don't see what it's to do with generative AI. And that's sort of the interesting bit here.
Good, good. Let's debate this because I actually couldn't disagree more. I disagree with this on two levels. The first is navigating the world doesn't just take a good understanding of the world. It takes enormous amounts of creativity and invention on the fly. In fact, the most recent self-driving AI presentation I saw from Tesla, and who the hell knows what's going on there, but even this is before generative AI, they talked about basing autopilot on language, on vocabulary, because intersections were so complicated, they had to invent a language to describe intersection components and then string together sentences as grammar and then help the system navigate that way. So I think navigating the world is a generative language problem in the broadest sense. And that is a very creative exercise. The second part of my response to you is, I think we as information workers up in our ivory towers underestimate the creativity it takes to do blue collar work, whether it's moving bricks around or factory work or whatever. I think there's an enormous amount of creativity. And you know, you watch these videos on TikTok or whatever, where they're showing laborers doing very creative things to supercharge their work, you know, to sand off tiles and move dirt around. And you can tell who's like the good one and who's the lazy one, right? This is creative work. It's just creative work with your hands. And so on that level as well, I think, whether it's making a cup of coffee or constructing a home, an enormous amount of creative work is being done there that we're underestimating.
Well, first of all, I mean, maybe, but you're conflating LLMs with creativity, right? And I don't think that's correct, right?
Like, not creativity. I would say they should be conflated with reasoning, with the ability to creatively navigate situations and to creatively generate new pathways through problems and information sets. Absolutely, I relate them to creativity.
Yeah, but I just don't say the generative AI is necessarily the correct technology for that. There have been decades of applied research that is out in the field about agents and how agents navigate through the world. So
yeah, all of that needs to get thrown out. All that needs to get
thrown out. No, it doesn't, man. Like, what the hell? Like, how do you know enough about this stuff to say it all needs to be thrown out?
Let me tell you what I mean. I was listening to This American Life when GPT 4.0 came out, and there was a Microsoft researcher they were interviewing, and he was talking about how they were looking at GPT 4 before it came out and doing diligence on the deal from Microsoft. And this is a dyed-in-the-wool, hardcore academic researcher. He's been working on AI his whole life. And he was talking about how they were throwing it questions and seeing how it would respond. And they gave 3.5 a series of objects, like 4 eggs, a book, a laptop, and let's say a bag of flour or something. They asked it, can you stack these things so that they are stable and build up on top of each other? And ChatGPT 3.5 had no freaking clue. It was like, put an egg down and put a book on top and then put the laptop on top and then put the flour on top of that. They asked ChatGPT 4 and it said, like, put the laptop at the bottom to create a solid base, put one egg on each corner, put the book on top, and then put the flour on top of that. And he said, and I get goosebumps just thinking about his little interview, he was like, I couldn't sleep that night. He said, I could not believe that this thing trained on text could reason about the shape and position of objects and how to stack. And so, Yanev, I think the revelation of ChatGPT or GPT is that this transformer, which is not new technology, actually, it's actually a number of years old, could reason about physical objects in the real world. And that, yes, that has thrown out entire areas of domain-specific AI research. And yes, I believe would form the basis of physically navigating the world in a way that all of that research was really possibly going in the wrong direction.
Well, I think that's an overly bold statement. What do you think, Emil?
I mean, I think I more agree with Chris than I do with you. I do think we should separate humanoids from other robots, because other robots developed for a simple task, lifting something and putting it on a shelf, cleaning the bottom of your pool, mopping floors, the Roomba. There's versions of these things that are around, but they haven't been reasoned. They sort of do old technology. But the idea that some humanoid can like open your pantry and you say, organize my pantry in 20 minutes or less, the most efficient way possible. It does feel like the LLMs, and maybe it takes a little ChatGPT-5, can translate logic and critical thinking and put it in the physical world in a way that hasn't been done before. And maybe that's the excitement that people are thinking about when they look at this figure deal and they're seeing that eventuality, whether this is the company to do it, how long it takes. There are separate questions for, is that the future? Which I think is more yes than no.
Yeah.
Yeah, but we don't need to imagine this, though. I've already seen demos of arms where you say, hey, sort these fruits, and it will go and grab the strawberries and put them into a pile and grab the whatever, the mangoes, and put them in a separate pile. And you've never said to them what strawberry or mango is and what you meant by sort and which ones you meant to pick up. And like, it, I mean, this is all recent revelations powered by transformers. And that's, I guess, my third point, Yanev. The first is navigating the world as a creative exercise. The second is blue-collar work is creative. The third is we may not be talking about LLMs as you know them, right? ChatGPT, but we are talking about transformer technology and potentially combined with diffusion technology when thinking about language very broadly. So describing an intersection in terms of grammar or describing the world in terms of language, it is very likely that applying transformers and diffusion models to the world is breakthrough thinking for hard science, physical bipedal robots.
I guess just to make a slightly orthogonal point, like what is interesting about humanoid robots is that the world's been designed by humans. And so I think this is less about the intersection of AI and so on. It's that if you want a robot that can navigate the world and can do all the things that humans can do, it makes sense for it to be human shaped and have the physical abilities of a human.
The breakthrough reality of ChatGPT is that it has hacked the human interface, which is language. That's why it is so mind-blowingly cool. And as you just said, Yanev, the revelation of a humanoid robot will be that it has hacked human space because the world is designed for human shapes. Yeah. And so when you combine a creature that has human cognition and language with human physicality and dexterity, like, holy shit, we're living in the future. I've just never seen such a rapid acceleration of technology that'll disrupt our way of life.
I don't disagree with you. I guess there's this thing in the back of my mind that's maybe powering some of this, which is that the world never really works out, or technology never really transpires the way mainstream science fiction predicts that it will. So I think to the extent that we have, like, you know, robot maids walking and talking amongst us, it's so trite and has been predicted for so long that I somehow feel like technology will surprise us and we will end up in a different future than the one that has been predicted. But that's a vibe argument more than a particularly strong logical one. We never predict the future very accurately.
Well, yeah, let's talk about that final piece of skepticism. Emil, you said this could be like driverless cars, right? And I fully agree. The question is, as Elon Musk keeps saying, building the prototype is easy. Building the machine that builds thousands and thousands of these machines at scale is the hard problem. And so are these robots from Figure designed for and capable of being mass produced at scale? And what is the return on investment? Although what's the return on investment on a human life, right? The lifetime value of human labor, that's pretty high. And so you could spend quite a bit of money on a robot before it becomes uneconomical. Number one, can they get it to be mass produced? And number two, is it like the driverless car problem? And I don't see any reason why it wouldn't be, which is that last mile, that last 5-10% is impossible to solve in the short to medium term. And I can't imagine why it wouldn't be a harder problem than the driverless car problem.
Well, because cars have to interact with other cars and humans on the street. If you had a humanoid in your home that cooked you eggs every morning, there's less of a negative externality problem.
Maybe, but your home is full of complex objects and complex interactions and social cues, children and vulnerable meat puppets running around.
What if it was like mining coal? You could pick 1,000 things a humanoid could do that don't have negative externalities the way a driverless car in a crowded street in New York City might have.
That's fair.
It's also worth noting, and this is fairly fresh news, is that Waymo have now got approval to drive in the entire San Francisco Peninsula, Bay Area Peninsula, plus all of Metro LA. So I actually think, yes, it's taken longer and so on, but the driverless car future is kind of here. It seems like they've gotten there. That includes freeway driving.
Well, I, for one, welcome our robot overlords. I am ready to serve.
What choice do you have, Chris?
Give me at least the illusion of choice of giving up my free will.
This episode of the Startup Podcast is brought to you by Vanta. The team at Vanta are passionate about helping you secure your business by vastly cutting down on the time to get compliant with frameworks like ISO 27001, SOC 2, and Essential 8. Vanta lets you close deals, sleep better at night, and get back to building your product. Help yourself and help the podcast by going to vanta.com/TSP for an exclusive 20% off deal.
All right. Our second topic today is Elon Musk suing OpenAI. Emil, tell us what the backstory is on all this.
I think the claim, as I read it, was basically that the initial investment was a charitable donation, and a charitable donation is tax deductible, and there's tax rules around that. You have to become a 501c3, you have to have a purpose that's considered charitable, and then that was used to develop a for-profit technology, and therefore it was used for a different purpose than it was solicited. The argument that I've read in editorials is like, well, every company should do that. Let's just take charitable money, do a 501c3, drop a for-profit company underneath it, and then have that generate profit. Like, what a great hack. And so the first part of it is an interesting question. It did start out as a charity. It's technically still a charity. But then Sam was clear in the beginning, if you read the emails with Elon, they're like, we have to pay competitive salaries to get the best engineers from Google and the like. And the only way to do that is to have some for-profit entity. So I kind of see both sides of it a little bit, but I do think the lawsuit is about this was the purpose of the money and it was not used for that purpose.
Yeah. So according to QZ and Google, the lawsuit claims a breach of contract, breach of fiduciary duty, and unfair business practices. I've seen it described in casual terms as like, they're just not doing what they promised they would do. And the context by which he gave them the money is not ultimately the context by which they're operating. And as you said, Emil, that's particularly egregious if you think about switching from nonprofit to commercial. Now, of course, you know, you said, well, everybody should do that. I don't know like how realistic that is, right? Like, I think VCs are not going to suddenly be wooed by, oh, you're a nonprofit. Well, in that case, here's $1 million, right? That's not like some hack to get more VC capital or more money from people, right? It's like, no, most investors, they don't want you to be a nonprofit. They want you to be for profit. What's your business model? What's your scale? What's your whatever? So I don't know that that's like something that people are going to go around lying about their nonprofit status. I do think it's particularly egregious if you've promised an investor or a high net worth, like, hey, give me your money for this nonprofit, and you suddenly pivot into being a commercial entity. Of course, that's an egregious pivot, let's call it.
But I'm not talking about lying. I'm saying, let's suppose you're an environmental organization and you're like solicit donations that are tax deductible. And you say the best way to help the environment is to build our own technology to take carbon out of the air. So I'm going to create this entity underneath and hire the best people in the world to do that. But it has to make money. That's a hack. I'm not saying anyone's lying. It's a potential hack. Or you just say, that's just weird. Like, I just don't think that should be done. I think Elon's saying like, this was a charitable purpose and it turned into primarily a commercial enterprise.
I'm sort of biased because I really believe in the power of commercial entities to drive social good. I find nonprofits, many of them, not all of them, but many of them, to be fairly feckless.
I think we're debating that though.
But if I gave my money to an environmental nonprofit and they said, you know what, Chris, we figured out the way to make the most impact on the environment is to build a carbon sequestration technology and commercialize the shit out of it, I'd be like, hell yeah, that's like what I want you to do. I want you to do the most efficacious thing to solve the problem of climate change. I don't want you to be screwing around doing warm and fuzzy media campaigns. Like, yeah, go solve the damn problem.
Why do we care about this?
Well, the reason I care about it is because number one is hypocrisy. And number two is what I call the Elon risk. So the first is hypocrisy. I think Musk is a hypocrite in this case. You know, he's building a private for-profit AI company, X.AI and robots and Optimus. And he wants Tesla board to give him more control over the company so that he can invest his AI thinking into that company. So he's basically threatened and blackmailed them to that point. And I think it's perfectly reasonable for one man in Elon Musk to be in control of Tesla and X.AI AI technology. And I think that's hypocrisy that he thinks somehow that OpenAI needs to maintain some complex governance nonprofit model and source model. And he's not doing the same thing. So I think the first thing is hypocrisy. We should call out hypocrisy where we find it. The second thing that's important for founders listening and people investing in the space is I think we need to start thinking more and more seriously about Elon risk. You know, there's a term in software called platform risk, right? Where if you rely on other people's platforms, those platforms will change and shift and erode and cannibalize you. And Twitter is the shining example of that for the Twitter developer ecosystem. I wonder at what point do we start talking about on a regular basis, diversifying our risk from Elon Musk? And I'm talking about the United States government relying on him for space and us relying on him for, you know, for all the other shit that he does.
Content moderation.
It's just like, so much stuff, right? Like he's so tiresome in his like hero complex that he needs to stick his finger in every damn pie. And he does it so effectively because of his brand and his capital. You know, he owns AI, he owns space tech, he owns the town square, he owns the whatever. How long until this guy like flips his shit even more than he has and shrivels into a ball? And we need to think about Elon risk as actually a global threat.
Whoa.
Emil can't keep a straight face.
Off you go.
I mean, thank God for Elon. Like, holy shit. He's like a gift to humanity. Seriously. I mean, think about all the things he's accomplished and he's trying to accomplish more. And why would one hate that? Like, you may hate the style. I mean, like, whatever. And sure, any one investor who's investing in any one of his companies can evaluate their own key man risk and decide they might lose it all if something happens to Elon or just gets bored with the project. But, you know, that's their fucking problem.
I mean, but you just said it, Emil. Elon represents key man risk for the United States and the world. I'm being very serious about that, right? So he has accelerated space technology and he's kind of reignited the space race. And he is a key man risk and SpaceX is a key man risk or key company risk in that category now. Tesla is not the most important car company in the world, of course, but owns the charging network, owns a solar business, is owning more and more energy technology and is enmeshing itself in the energy grid. And then again, Twitter or X, and say what you will about that, and robotics and on and on. This is key man risk. I'm not picking on Elon Musk even today. And I'm not saying I hate him. I'm not saying he's done bad things. Let's put that aside for other people to judge. I'm just saying he is key man risk. If he gets run over by a bus or if he decides to flip the script or he has a mental break from, and this is what's brought it up for me today, he's pursuing yet more and more and more complex challenges. Now he's in a complex lawsuit with one of the most important companies in the world. How many challenges does he want to take on? He hasn't seen a challenge he doesn't like. And when does this threaten his full-throated ability to execute? And what does that represent as key man risk?
I mean, it's kind of an odd tautology in the way you phrase it, which is he's so important. That means he's so far ahead of the next best guy or gal that we have to be worried. But then you're like, yeah, but he's so far ahead of the next best guy in Dallas. Why would you want to do anything to stop him?
Hang on a second. You've coupled two things. I'm concerned about him does not automatically mean we need to stop him. I'm saying we need to diversify, de-risk. We need to think about that. I'm talking about government policy, about investment strategy, about founders making bets and decisions moving forward. I'm not saying anybody should do anything to curtail Elon Musk as an individual human being. I'm saying, what is the US government doing to make sure that Boeing and Lockheed and others are in a position to provide second or third vendor alternatives? What are we doing to provide alternative satellite networks to Starlink? What are we doing to, Figure is a great alternative to Optimus, but what are we proactively doing to dissipate that key man risk?
Let me run this past you. I think the answer here is corporate governance, right? These are not companies that Elon owns 100% of. These are companies that have a variety of investors. Some of them are public companies. And I think the way to make sure that Elon can be Elon without the risk that he goes like total Bond villain on us and like destroys the world is to have proper corporate governance. And, you know, a couple of weeks ago, this situation with the court in Delaware ruling that his stock option grant from Tesla was unreasonable and basically revoking it. Now, whether we agree with that or not, I think the argument that was made is that his board had failed to be independent of him. They've failed in their fiduciary duties. So when companies become too powerful, the remedy is antitrust is breaking them up. When an individual becomes too powerful, the remedy is to make sure that there are counterbalances. And that is what corporate governance is for. So I feel like to the extent that your concern is valid, Chris, like that's where it needs to be focused, is to make sure that we have good quality boards running these companies.
Let me challenge that a little bit, because I think the dynamics have changed. I think when you look at Trump, who as president existed inside a deep governance structure designed for checks and balances. When you think about Sam Altman, who existed inside a structure that was experimental and new and nascent, but was ostensibly designed for corporate governance over him. When you think about Elon Musk inside his own governance structures, I think these rules don't apply as well anymore. Because these people, thanks to social media and the cult of personality and what have you, have become outsized in their influence over their followers, employees, and markets. And they have shown a lack of shame and self-constraint. So Sam Altman managed to play that game, coming out looking like the winner. He was not dissuading his employees from walking out the door or threatening to walk out the door from OpenAI and creating essentially a mob mentality of like, if you want to kick me out and apply the governance at me, well, I'll just eviscerate the company and they can come with me. He didn't say that out loud, but that's what happened. And I'm reminded of like Travis, where corporate governance caught up with him. And Travis was the old school type of person. Quiet, stoic, taking it on the chin, dealing with the board directly. What if he decided, hey, why don't half you guys come with me? Hey, Emil and Chris and Rachel and whatever, why don't you guys threaten to walk out of the company and tell Gurley and all those fuckers to piss off, right?
God, I wish we did.
I wish we did too, Emil. And so this is a new generation of leader with a new generation of power where I don't think they're constrained by corporate or governmental governance. I think if Elon Musk was told by his board to sit down and shut up, he would tell them, how about you go fuck yourself? And the company would implode under him, or he would do whatever he does.
I mean, that's one direction to go. The other direction to go is in this last bill that Biden passed, there's hundreds of billions of dollars of subsidies for other electric car makers, hundreds of billions of dollars to strengthen them and diversify the bets. NASA has been on other space companies that just haven't worked, right? Just haven't been able to do it. There is an alternative satellite network, and it's been up there for years and years and years. It's just not as fast and cheap and modern as what we have.
Well, hang on. As Elon has, we don't have it.
As Elon has, but I do think the government has the right and power, if there was ever necessary, to ask or order Elon under the takings clause to give them capacity on those satellites if they need it for work. Like, you know, the government has supreme ultimate power, ultimately. They just don't exercise it except in dire circumstances. And they have in some of these other areas. So I feel like the bets are spread. They just failed. Like Ford sucks at electric cars. Is that Elon's fault?
I do think Yarnev's analogy to a Bond villain is an interesting one. And I'm not sitting here saying Elon is evil or Elon is a Bond villain.
Well, what are the backup plans? I went with your non-sole source dependency on innovation in these areas. If that's
right. And I agree with you that government has, you know, eminent domain or what have you to be able to take some of these assets back. I do think, though, we have seen evidence of the US government being incredibly deferential to Elon Musk. And again, while they theoretically have the power to seize or control certain things, I do think his cult of personality has an interesting soft power that we haven't seen a lot of before. And I think it's embodied in its most evil and most fascist in Trump, actually. And I think these are all points on a spectrum and clusters in a pattern.
And let's not over-focus on the SpaceX thing, because that is a unique beast for sure. Like, very government-dependent and very sort of fully outsourced in a way that, like, whoever thought NASA was going to be that dependent on any one company, forget the person. But the electric cars thing, there's been subsidies out there for anyone who's willing to build them for a long time. And he's just built a better one. So it's like the bets have been made. Like, let's not have any one company. Let's give them all a boost because of what we think the potential benefits has happened. He just happens to have won. So what would you do there?
I don't know. I just don't see enough people talking about it. And I'm also not just talking about electric cars. I'm talking about he's plugging his infrastructure into the grid. He has autonomous robots rolling around in the roads. He has physical bipedal robots on the verge of coming out, depending on how much bullshit you believe is there. He has the town square and superpowers on a large influential information network.
Chris, you're president of the world. What would you do?
I want to know that too.
I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. And I'm not prescribing a solution. I'm just highlighting key man risk. And I think this lawsuit is an example of Elon Musk chasing everything that he perceives to be an existential threat to humanity, chasing it down without constraint. I think he believes that this OpenAI lawsuit is a crusade against the risks of AI. And that's yet another thing he wants to add to his plate.
Can we pivot into something that wasn't on our agenda that I find interesting that's related to this? This debate between open and closed AI that's been happening on Twitter most recently with Mark Andreessen, Vinod, Sam Altman, and Elon, right? All four of them have been sort of battling on this open versus closed foundation models, I guess. And that sort of, Vinod said, well, would you have open sourced the Manhattan Project? We certainly wouldn't have wanted the Germans to figure, or the Japanese to figure out we were building an atomic bomb. So why, if AI is going to be that powerful, why would we want the Chinese to hack it? It shouldn't be open sourced. It'd be interesting to see what you guys think about this, because I think it's an important question for the future of AI.
Well, there's kind of broadly two schools of thought, right? There is the theory of like, hey, the good guys need the biggest stick. And we need to be in control of the biggest stick, and we will act benevolently to maintain a free and open world. And I think that's the closed source model. That's the Manhattan Project model. That's the US as the shining city on the hill model. And then there is the peer-to-peer, mutually insured destruction, equal threats from all sides creates a stable ecosystem worldview where, hey, when you have multiple actors with atomic weapons, you don't have to rely on one actor to be the good guy. The world will find an equilibrium and debate things as peers. And I think we've seen both play out during the atomic age, from the Manhattan Project all the way through to Russia getting their own bombs.
I think the Manhattan Project is really quite an apt comparison, because the guys doing the Manhattan Project were scientists. Scientists were open source long before software became open source, right? Their impulse was to publish it. And there was actually one guy, one of the leaders of the Manhattan Project, Leo Szilard, and he was the guy who was lobbying his fellow scientists to say, we got to keep this shit quiet because the world will not be better from having this information shared. I think that's really interesting. And in the end, he was successful, right? A lot of the fundamental research, apparently the main reason the Germans lost the race to build a nuclear weapon is because there was a discovery of some contamination in the carbon rods that were typically used that was stopping progress. And the Americans figured that out and they didn't publish. And so the Germans went down the wrong path. And that is probably why there was no German bomb. And so it's really interesting. This goes to geopolitics, right? And whether you want mutual assured destruction or whether there are certain capabilities that are effectively military capabilities that you don't want to give away a lead on.
Yeah, but isn't this also related to, on a slightly more local level, you know, democracy versus dictatorship, right? This is now going to be a very, very controversial statement maybe to some of our audience, but like, I think the general consensus is, you know, the good guys won World War II. Of course they won, right? And of course, America coming out on top was the right answer. But there's a lot of debate to be had what happened afterwards. Of course, America set up these global institutions intended to minimize or mitigate the chances of all of that happening again. But America also did a bunch of really shady shit, toppling dictators and propping up coups. And like, they were not always the good guys post-World War II. And they acted with impunity and continue to act with impunity. And so I do think there is something to be said about a multipolar world.
But you can't expect the superpowers to give away their power, right? I think this is like, the actual question, I'd be interested in your thoughts, Emil, is this powerful technology with military applications? And if the answer is yes, then whether we agree or not, it is going to be the prerogative of nation states to try to close things off. Now, will they succeed? I don't know. They tried it with encryption. They failed, right? So it's quite possible the genie's out of the bottle.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely enough security implications. But actually, I think the difference between post-World War II and now a rogue actor can cause disproportionate damage to the world. Whether it's a lab in Wuhan or a terrorist group that's flying planes into a building or a chemical weapon. And therefore, some of these tools, even if you have a Cold War among the nation states, can be abused by smaller numbers of people more efficiently than ever before. And that's a little scary. So how do you protect against that? I don't know if you can. Data and technology doesn't stay bottled up anymore. It's just impossible, right? Los Alamos cut communications, high security, X hundred people, and that was it. So it was like relatively easy to conceal it. Very hard to conceal software.
Can you imagine in today's day and age if Los Alamos was set up and like people started tweeting?
Yeah.
Like, hey, where are all the best nuclear scientists and physicists gone? What are they doing?
Or satellite pictures or on Google right. Maps. You see it on Google Maps?
Right. The global kind of sleuthing to figure out like, hang on a second, where did these guys all go? And like, what are they doing? And it's like, I think this has been true for a long time, this idea that our reach now far exceeds our grasp as human beings and small institutions. And this is perhaps the nuclear age was the first best example of that. Which is why, you know, speaking meta, it's so disheartening to me that we're reverting to nationalism and parochialism and disconnecting from each other, because I think what's needed is more interconnection, more global community, because it's now no longer about individual state actors that can somehow protect their borders. It's about extremists versus moderates. It's about liberal, small L liberal versus illiberal. And the world needs to act in concert. These nation states need to act in concert to protect against bad actors, bad individual actors. So yeah, it's disheartening that the pendulum is swinging in that direction.
All right, guys.
All right, guys. Emil, how can people find you on the internet?
I'm at Emil Michael on X.
I'm mostly on LinkedIn, so feel free to give me a connection or a follow there. I'm also on X, so if you want a slightly spicier version of me, you can find me there.
And you can follow me on all the social media at Chris Saad, or check out my newsletter at chrissaad.com/newsletter. All right, guys, catch you in the next one.
See ya.
See ya.
This episode of the Startup Podcast was brought to you by Vanta. Vanta helps businesses get and stay compliant by automating up to 90% of the work for the most in-demand compliance frameworks. With over 200 integrations, you can easily monitor and secure the tools your business relies on. Head to vanta.com/TSP for 20% off their incredible offering and start unlocking extra revenue today.